But can I tell you something?
Yeah.
One way that I am the kind of stereotypical dad from decades past is I do walk around the house turning lights off, saying, no one's in this room. We shouldn't be, shouldn't leave the lights on. And like kind of controlling the thermostat very carefully. Uh-huh. But one weird thing, not weird thing, one adorable thing that my kids have done.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's an adorable thing that you do.
Oh, no, like, no, it's not.
You think highly of yourself.
It's happened in years past, but for some reason, just in the last few weeks, in our living room, we have two heat registers from the furnace. Okay. And our two kids have each built this little like fort around the heat register.
Okay. Yeah.
Cora has one and Oliver has one.
Sort of like cats.
Is that what cats do?
Yeah. Cats like to keep warm. So they'll like put all their like, or they'll snuggle up near the heat register and stuff. And put
this is like Oliver's, for instance, is like, he has a little writing table. It's like 18 or 24 inches high, and he pushed it up against the register and then laid a blanket over it
over
and
put top,
put a pillow under it. And he, like, when he wakes up in the morning, he not only is prepared to go into his little fort, but he can climb up and turn the thermostat up a few degrees so the furnace comes on, and then he crawls in, and Cora does the same thing in hers. And so at this time of year, Shale, it's almost May. And so I have the thermostat set at 20 degrees centigrade.
Makes sense.
But they will wake up and turn it up to 23 or 24.
Adorable.
And in the last couple of days, I've like kind of been a dad about it and been like, listen, first of all, if you're cold, put a sweater and socks on, because they never have sweaters or socks on.
Mm-hmm.
But second of all, actually, you don't control the thermostat, and your mom and I do, and I have it programmed and stuff.
You have a smart thermostat?
Well, no, I have a thermostat.
Oh, okay.
It's from the 80s, probably. Like, you can program
it. You can still program it?
Yeah, if you want to call it that.
You just put punch cards in? You'd like put your program on a punch card, and then
you need a 5-inch floppy, but you can, it's like, there's like set points for basically for 6 a.m., 9 a.m., 12 p.m., 4 p.m.
Gotcha. Okay.
And nine or whatever it is every day. And you can set all of those. And So I set a little bit lower at night when we're all in bed and a little bit up.
Right.
I don't know. Doesn't matter.
What time do the kids get up? Because you should just set it at that time to go up to 23 degrees.
Yeah, but it doesn't need to be at 23 degrees at 7 in the morning in May.
I think I'm siding with your kids on this one.
Oh, my God.
I certainly understand your frustration, but there's two things. Thing one, it's real nice to get up in the morning and go in your fort and get cozy. Like, I can appreciate that.
Your bed is your fort. You're nice and cozy in bed, and now it's time to get up and make Dad some coffee. which Cora actually does every day, which is amazing. But
that is amazing. What you need is a programmable coffee pot.
If only.
From the 80s. Thing two is, like, since they've built the forts around the registers, it shouldn't really matter how much they turn up the thermostat. The house should still stay cold because all the hot air is just staying inside the fort.
Yeah, exactly. I think that they are, what's the word? They're poorly sealed enough that the house still warms up. And they come out of them like they've been in a schwitz, like they've got rosy cheeks and perspiration on their forehead.
The furnace is trying to heat the house up to like 24 degrees.
Yeah.
But all of that warmth is getting stuck in the fort. And so probably inside the fort, it's like 50.
And so the reason I'm bringing it up is because usually when we record, I'm in our basement sitting at a little office desk, and there's a heat register like almost directly over my head. And I rushed home tonight to record with you, and it's 9 p.m. on an almost May evening, and this thing is just blasting air at me. And I'm like,
you're thinking about taking my hat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, anyways, you're right, and then Alan, sure enough, dad problems.
I ran upstairs, and sure enough, the thermostat was set for 23, even though it's probably 18 degrees outside. But
I got a question. I got a dad mentality related question for you.
Oh, okay.
Do you have any 3-way light switches in your house?
That's an excellent question, because there was definitely some in the house that I grew up in.
Okay.
There are not any in our current house, but only because when we purchased this house about 15 years ago, and my partner Lisa's dad is a power engineer and something of an electrician as well. I don't know if he has his ticket, but he rewired almost our entire house for us.
Wow.
And put pot lights in and stuff. And so I suspect that when it was purchased, there would have been 3-way lights, but that he eradicated them as soon as possible.
Excised them.
Yeah.
This is a lot less interesting a topic of conversation if you don't have any. But I heard some people on another podcast that I listened to this week complaining about the orientation of the switches and like how it bothers them if like the one at the bottom of the stairs isn't flicked up if the lights are on, or if, you know,
right.
Is that a thing? Does that annoy you when like the 3-way light switches aren't in your preferred orientation?
It doesn't bother me as a resident. I know that it bothers electricians, because I've even talked to electricians who have complained about the Roberts head screws that are used to affix the plates around electrical sockets not being aligned vertically.
Oh, right.
But, but the real problem with like a lot of the 3-way switches, the way that they're installed, sometimes you get to a state where you flick one of the two switches and the light doesn't switch between on and off, or vice versa.
Oh, well, that sounds like a bad problem to have.
Oh, okay.
In my experience, how they're generally set up to work is like there's one on one side of the room and another on the other side of the room, or one at the bottom of the stairs and one at the top of the stairs. And when you flick the switch, the light, if it's off, it comes on, and if it's on, it goes off.
Right.
But there's no actual, like, you can't control the orientation of the switches, because if you use the one at the bottom of the stairs to turn the lights on and it's in the proper orientation, but then you walk up the stairs and turn the lights off, the one at the bottom of the stairs is now in the up orientation and the lights are off. And right. To me, that like is just how that works. You still know you need to switch the switch to turn the light on or off. Doesn't really bother me whether you're flicking it up or down, but apparently that really bothers some people.
And they're not electricians.
No, they're not electricians, just homeowners.
Hmm.
They're talking about replacing all of their switches with like stateless smart switches so that they can't have that problem anymore. And I was like, oh my God, thank God I'm not that particular.
Mm-hmm. I thought for sure that when you started this part of the conversation, you're going to say, do you have a 3-way switch in your home? And I would say yes or no and whatever. And then you would say, because I heard that Hangar 11 burned down because a 3-way switch did, or something like that. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sedeby, and I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hello, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Hangar 11. What's that all about?
Hangar 11 is a hangar in the old Edmonton Municipal Airport called Batchford Field. And right.
It's pretty close to my house, and it's like directly close to your work.
Yeah, just at the end of the block, actually, from the entrance to Ernus, and the Learning Resources Building, which is where Ernus and the one of the major wings that houses the Nate Culinary Arts Department. And yeah, it caught fire under the ground last week.
Yeah. So crazy. I like saw, my sister sent me like something on Instagram. It was a video of someone, like someone was taking a video of it burning. And I was like, oh my God, that's that hangar. And so we like drove out to take a look at what was happening, and it had already collapsed, but it was an enormous building. And apparently it was like completely made out of wood. It was like a heritage building. Apparently they had plans to turn it into some kind of commercial retail space or something.
Oh, was there? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, originally, I don't know, I read a few things about it. Originally, there was a plan for Nate to take it over and use it as like student housing. And then apparently Nate backed away from that plan, and then a developer got some money from the city to turn it into some kind of, hip retail space or something like that.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they, I don't know. I'm wondering if, you know, maybe the accident happened because of some construction that was going on or something. But you say three-way switch, so.
You specifically mentioned or asked me if I had any, if I had
anything to say about it. Yeah,
exactly. Which I don't, except I can tell you what my experience was because I was down the block when it happened. But
yeah.
And this was, you're right, it was a very large, to be honest, I didn't know it was called Hangar 11 before the fire, but it was, if you were driving on Princess Elizabeth Avenue or Kingsway by Nate, like it was a very prominent building and very distinct because, like you said, it's an old wood structure, everything white except for the roof, and it had the words "Learn to Fly" written across it in big letters over the front of it, facing Princess Elizabeth. Anyway, so on Monday, I think it would have been Monday, April 22nd, because, I know it was a Monday because we weren't open for service that day, but we were just doing prep in the lab. And just like you described, some people started showing us clips, and we from the videos that we could see on social media, it actually looked like the building immediately adjacent to us might be on fire. And so we had done some things to just like, we didn't receive any, like most of the students and all of the staff have a Nate kind of alert app on their phones, and we didn't receive any messages.
Oh, that's weird.
So We were aware that perhaps we might be asked to evacuate soon. And so we had that in mind in terms of the scope of work we were getting the students to take on and everything. But, but yeah, it turned out it was more like at the end of the block. Some staff were able to like go out one of the exits just down the hall from our class and see, like, there was lots of activity there. There was loads of emergency vehicles and people just standing and watching. And there was a huge plume of smoke in the sky. But yeah, we didn't really change anything about our class until it was dismissal time. And we said, just so you know, there's a fire down the block, and depending on where you're parked, like there might be lots of barricades and emergency vehicles and all that. So, anyways, so yeah, by the time class was dismissed, the structure was gone, but there was lots of, there was still a fire and emergency activity. Yeah. And
I think that fire burned until like late into the night. Like, when we went and looked at it, it was like 11 p.m. or something, and it was still like a raging fire.
Is that right? Yeah, like at ground level. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was bad enough. I don't obviously know what goes into making these decisions, but actually all of the classes on the NAIT main campus were canceled the next day.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, I guess. So they just told everyone not to come in. Did you have to like do remote classes or anything, or you just, your classes were canceled?
I'm sure others did have to do remote classes. Like it was, it wasn't strictly classes are canceled. It was no one is to come to campus today.
Right.
And so, for us, like there's no theoretical or online component to the course. It's just the service at Earnest. And that night we happened to have, the Tuesday, the night that, campus was closed. Mm-hmm. We had a banquet. And so I, you know, messaged my supervisors to clarify, like, because they announced it at, it was probably 7 in the morning when they announced it. And I said, well, like our class doesn't start until 4 p.m. and we have a banquet. Should I expect to possibly still have class? And they said, no, no one's meant to come to campus today. So,
So the banquet was canceled.
Yeah.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. What was the banquet for?
It was a private group.
Okay. Fair enough.
It was a private group that had booked, a group of about 60 people or so that had booked the dining room. Yeah. And sorry, the reason for closing campus was air quality. It was, as far as I know, not because of any lingering threat of
danger
fire
or anything. Yeah.
It was air quality. Just they had, yeah.
And then you were back on Wednesday?
Yeah.
And did it smell really smoky inside the school on Wednesday or?
No, not at all. When I left on Monday, like it smelled, I mean, I hate that I have to say this, but like when I left on Monday, it smelled like a fire season evening in Alberta.
Right,
like you could certainly, like it definitely smelled of smoke, like a campfire kind of smell. I wasn't there on Tuesday, but then yeah, Wednesday it.
Not a hint. Nothing.
Yeah.
Crazy. Well, glad you're okay. It's too bad about that building. Mm-hmm. I feel like that area and the development that they're trying to do there is just nothing but setbacks, but it's too bad.
That's one for our municipal issues podcast spinoff.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So, Alan, do we have any follow-up?
The big circle around that I was trying to get to that I never quite did was I rushed home from work to get to start this recording. And then the register was blasting heat at me and I had to stop our conversation to run upstairs. Well, first of all, to close the register, but then I ran upstairs to see that the furnace had been set at 23.
The thermostat had been tampered with.
Am I repeating myself?
Nope.
Oh, okay. I didn't think so. Because we talked about it before we started recording.
Yeah.
Anyways, the other thing that made me really rushed for this recording was that I had seen that there was some follow-up for the David Chang, sorry, the not the David Chang.
Trademark bullying case.
Yeah. Yeah. Cease and desist story that we talked about far too long on the last recording. Mm-hmm. It was an article in The Guardian and then in many other news sources. I did see that Chang issued some kind of statement about it. And also my impression was that, you know, they had somehow withdrawn all of the cease and desist letters. And in my rush to find that information before we recorded, everything that I read, including an article in the CBC, said that Momofuku will not enforce a trademark on Chili Crunch. But where it was standing at the end of our last conversation was that they didn't actually own the trademark rights to Chili Crunch, only to Chile Crunch.
Right.
And so there's probably a more clear example, or maybe there isn't because it's trademark law. But to me, it was totally ambiguous. It was like, are they not pursuing the trademark with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, or are they just not going to enforce it? I don't know. It's this is the best that I can do right now, Shiel.
Yeah, that's fair. Probably the reason for that is because, you know, people like to get excited about trademark bullies. And once the trademark bullies are like, oh, whoops, we didn't really mean to bully anyone, and so we're not going to worry about this, then nobody gives a shit anymore. Excuse my language.
But it was multiple sources that said they will not enforce it. And so then in the very brief reading that I did, it didn't say whether or not they'd actually received the rights to it. If I'm remembering right, CBC and also USA Today, at the very least, it said they will not enforce it. So,
right.
But yeah, you're right. It's kind of like a...
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that, like, I don't know. I don't know how much I want to talk about this because I haven't really read anything that, you know, would disambiguate what, you know, what you were just talking about. Mm. But part of their case for applying for the trademark for Chili Crunch was that they had the trademark for Chile Crunch and that they were enforcing it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that was, you know, that was in the name of them building a case to be able to trademark Chili Crunch, which is, from what I understand, kind of a difficult case to make for a trademark because it's what's called descriptive.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like regardless of whether they're going to pursue trying to get the trademark for Chili Crunch, if they're not enforcing their trademark on Chile Crunch, then they don't have much of a case either way. So, but what I assume happened is like a bunch of stuff was happening behind the scenes, and a bunch of people who make decisions for the company weren't really aware of what was happening or what was going on. And then when it blew up in the media, it was like, why are we going to all this trouble? And then they just dropped it, as I'm assuming right. Kind of what happened. But anyway,
that's all I got though.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Well, do I have follow-up? Maybe like the entire episode is follow-up.
Oh, how do you mean?
Well, a few episodes ago, I was lamenting that I never get to come and hang out for like the special events that you do at Ernest's. And you made me aware that there was like a fancy dinner that was going to be coming up in like a few weeks. I think this was about 6 weeks ago, so maybe like three shows ago or some such. Mm-hmm. And so you told me about this dinner. I went online. There were tickets available. I bought tickets for my sister and myself so that we could come and have a fancy meal at Ernest's. And the dinner was going to be being provided by Blair Labsack, who we had talked about. It was probably on that episode where we talked about Blair and the chef in residence at Nate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
And that also an alumni of the chef in residence program, Rod Butters, was going to be coming from BC to help put on this dinner as well. Right. So So I was pretty excited.
And I'll just say, and like, it really was a collaboration dinner. I think that the way that it was marketed, Nate, or some parts of Nate, was a little bit confusing because the title of the dinner was Okanagan Table. But even if you ask, because Rod Butters is based out of Kelowna, and he has a cookbook called The Okanagan Table. It was at his request that Blair come and do a collaborative dinner. Right. And so it kind of morphed into something maybe a little bit different than the organizers originally had envisioned, but it was awesome.
But like, they already had the trademark on it, so they had to keep the name.
So I don't know. Like it's in a way kind of undersells Blair's contribution because he did,
right,
you know, half the dishes and collaborated with Rod. It was billed as an Okanagan Table dinner, but it was equal parts Rod Butters out of Kelowna and Blair Labsack out of Edmonton.
Right. So it was an Okanagan and Alberta Prairie dinner.
Yeah. What do you call us? Yeah. Central Albertan.
Central Prairie. Albertan. Sure.
Aspen Parkland. I don't know.
And the dinner was also ostensibly a fundraiser for the Nate Culinary Olympic team.
Yeah. Not ostensibly. Yeah. It was really and truly.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. And so all of the profit from the dinner went to the Nate Culinary team.
Yeah. And so there was like a little bit of a reception before the dinner. And then the dinner itself was, I guess, four courses. Mm-hmm. Four courses with a palate cleanser. And yeah, I just thought it would be fun because like we kind of got to see it from two different sides. So like I got to come and enjoy the event and eat the dinner, and you got to work on preparing it for the week. So I just thought it would be fun to sort of like talk about our disparate experiences around that. And, you know, sure. You can maybe talk about like how things sort of came together, and then I can talk about how I felt the result was or something like that.
Sure. It's in a lot of ways, the conversation will mirror our Nate Chef in Residence conversation, because it was kind of right. A similar concept, but much more condensed. So where the right. Nate Chef in Residence, which like you said, Rod Butters had been the Chef in Residence in 2018, and Blair had been the Chef in Residence just this year. That stretches over the course of a week. And we have, for my class anyways, we have, you know, a day to prep and then a day to do a reception and then two dinner services following that. For this one, it was kind of all collapsed on 2 days where you have one day to prep with the two chefs and then one service that's the reception and then four-course dinner for, it was about 110 guests. But in terms of like a lot of the stuff we talked about with Chef in Residence, like the procurement was a big piece, right? Because usually the chefs that are being invited in have like they tend to work with, say, very specific regional or seasonal ingredients, which can be a challenge for us to procure, especially if they're not from our region. So that, definitely that played into this one. Do you think that before we get into that, like, should we do a high level menu overview or just go dish by dish or what?
So the reception had like, appetizer stations.
Yeah.
I don't remember everything. Okay. Let me see. There was a toast with peanut butter and something.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Peanut butter thing sandwich, yeah. No, so for the reception, there were four service stations, and there were also two past hors d'oeuvres as well.
I don't think I got any of those.
Oh, no.
We showed up late for the reception, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Fashionably so, I'm sure.
I guess, yeah.
So for the service stations, there were two dishes that were designed by Rod and two dishes that were designed by Blair. And so Rod's the first one, like you said, it was like a little crostini. It was called Sunny's Chicks on a Raft.
Okay.
So Rod has a few restaurants in and around Kelowna.
I don't think I had eaten at any of them. Like,
oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
The kind of flagship one is called Rod's Regional Table. One that I had eaten there when I was in Naramata, and he at the time had another one called Micro, that was like a small plates and cocktail bar, just I think next door or two doors down from Rod's, which was one of my favorite couple meals in Kelowna. And he also now has a brunch place called Sunny's, and so this dish was called Sunny's Chicks on a Raft, and it's a crostini with peanut butter and bacon and soft scrambled eggs and green onions.
Oh, right.
So it's just like an, bacon and eggs with peanut butter, a really nice but fun little canapé. And his other one,
was like a Dungeness crab bisque or something.
Yeah, I don't know if this came across to the folks in the reception room, but it's called a crab cappuccino.
Oh, that's right.
It does not have coffee in it.
No.
But it's one of his signature dishes. It features in his cookbook. And the conceit is that you have a lovely kind of coffee-colored Dungeness crab bisque that's topped with, it served in a little cappuccino cup, topped with milk foam. And then, garnished with, ours was garnished with Tobiko and fried fennel fronds. You sip it out of the cup as if it were a cappuccino.
I really like that one. The peanut butter and egg toast, I don't know if like the way it was being assembled on the night just didn't do it justice or what the situation is, but did not enjoy it.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. I found it pretty weird.
I wonder, like maybe a balance kind of issue. It's funny, like there was a point in the night where the students and the Nate culinary team members who were tasked with serving it, they were rushing back to the kitchen to toast more bread and everything because they said it was moving a lot faster than we expected. But
right,
like it's kind of like a quirky, it's almost like a what's that Elvis Presley sandwich, like peanut butter and bacon kind of thing. Right, like it's a kind of unconventional
fried peanut butter and banana or something.
It's kind of
it's like a brunch mashup or something.
Yeah, like a neo-American brunch thing.
Yeah, I could see, like, if the eggs were really nice and if the crostini was really nice. The crostini was, like, a little chewy and the eggs were a little cold and I don't know. It just didn't really hit. But the crabuccino was really good.
That's what we were calling it in the kitchen, but I was scared to say that in front of Rod Butters because it doesn't say crabuccino in the book or whatever. It says crab cappuccino, but it just they lead together so easily.
Yeah,
that's exactly what we were calling it. But it's a really nice, it's a really nice kind of bisque. It's, basically like a, almost like a double stock method. Like we brought in whole Dungeness crabs and, made a stock with them, use that stock to, you know, kind of infuse it with even more of the same aromatics that were in the stock and, a bit of roux and then some novel garnishes. So,
yeah. So I like that one. And then Blair's were bison heart?
Yeah, that's right.
Skewer? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With a kind of theatrical presentation. I don't know if you got to see that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I did. So yeah, they were kind of flambeing it, or they were pouring some kind of liquor in like a little channel, and then lighting the liquor on fire and then roasting the skewer over top of it or something. Is that
So it was interesting because when like the chefs sent us the recipes weeks out, and this dish was called bison flaming heart,
right?
And there was a description of how to clean and skewer bison heart, and there was a recipe for a rub or a marinade, I guess, that was primarily ancho chili. And then we were reading it and we're like, well, like it says there was some ambiguous note in the recipe that just said like flambé if desired or flambéing is optional. Okay. But we were wondering beforehand, well, you know, what should we use to flambé? And is this like, you know, a classic flambé in a pan or what? And so before Blair came, we had the bison heart cleaned and we had it marinating. And then when he came, he had someone bring in, they were like birch logs. Well, like, right. I don't know, birch tree branches that were maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And they had...
Yeah, and like hollowed out kind of.
Yeah, like, sorry, I guess they were birch logs split in half and then embedded in the cut face of the birch. There was like this like thick cast iron trough.
Right.
And so the idea was that we would have these, we did actually pre-grill the mm-hmm. skewers. So they were cooked or par cooked, and they would get laid into these troughs, and then the chef would douse them in liquor and then light mm-hmm. them on fire, or light the trough on fire. And we had some, well, fairly high proof rye, 45% or 90 proof rye that was actually left over from Blair's time as chef in res. And we did a test with that, and it did technically flambe, but it wasn't very dramatic. And so I did have to go out and buy Everclear to bolster just to fortify the rye. And I think they also infused it with herbs. And so, yeah, that's what was happening, is there was kind of par grilled bison heart skewers in a birch trough being doused with
rye and Everclear.
Everclear and rye, and then set on fire. So I don't know. Did you see that? You saw the process?
Seemed like it was working pretty well. I would say all of the stations, the people who were presenting the food seemed a little, what's the word? Like, not super confident about what they were doing. The service of each canapé was like pretty slow, and like they didn't really have a system for how to like do more than one thing at once or something. So it was kind of like there was like, even by the time I got there was like lineups, and it was taking a really long time. Like it was taking like 2 or 3 minutes to do one portion of certain things. And so that wasn't great, but it was like really cool to see them. Yeah. Like the way that they were doing the bison heart was almost like a yakitori grill, only using alcohol instead of binchotan to like to grill them. Yeah, so that was really cool. And that one was really, really good. The bison heart was like super tender and had like a lot of really good flavor, and it was very well seasoned. And yeah, I really enjoyed that one. That and the crabuccino were my favorites. And then what was cool. Blair's other one? It's kind of
It was a corn dog.
Oh, that's right.
So yeah, it was a hunter sausage corn dog that was garnished with mustard and pickled shallot.
Yeah, it was good, but maybe not as memorable as the bison heart skewer. Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I could see how it's not as memorable because there wasn't any of the, there was no open flames involved, but I definitely could have eaten a couple dozen of those. Yeah. Yeah. And those were sausages that were, they were actually made at the butchery by Range Road. Yeah. And they just brought them in, and the student made a batter and
dipped them and fried them,
dunked them, fried them. And
yeah, they were good.
Yeah.
So that was the reception.
There were the two past hors d'oeuvres as well.
And what were they?
Rod's was a spot prawn crudo. I don't know. Did you get a chance to try that? It was just served, like it was a past hors d'oeuvre on a spoon. Very simple. Like it was spot prawns, in a marinade of like citrus and chili. And, that was it basically. Like it was two halves of a spot prawn on a spoon.
I would have loved to have tried that. I don't know if it was like a problem of like running out of the product, or they just like gave up on serving things by the time we got there, because they also were supposed to have been passing like wine, and there was just nobody passing wine. It was just not happening. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. I don't know what, if it was a congested space and it was hard to get or
wasn't that congested by the time we got there? Like there was people milling about, but it wasn't like crazy. There were like empty tables and stuff, and
the past hors d'oeuvre from Blair was like a sausage tartlet. Okay. So little tart shells that were filled with pork and fennel sausage, again from the butchery, with some fromage frais and apple butter. Nice. Yeah, it was good.
Cool. Yeah, so then I don't know what time we got to the reception, probably like 20 minutes before the actual sit down meal time. And then everyone kind of moved. The reception was like in another room that was kind of down the hall from where the Ernest dining room was. And then they came and gathered everyone, and people started moving over to be seated in the Ernest dining room. And the way that the dinner was set up was basically like family style, large group tables. And you were just based on when you bought a ticket or something, you were just put at a table with other diners.
I'm sure a lot of it was trying to piece together tables of 10, because I think it was meant to be 10 or 11 tables of 10 guests. And so based on group sizes, they would just mix and match as they needed.
But. Yeah, so we had kind of an interesting experience when we arrived. A host brought us to our table, and the table was already, I guess it would have been 10 people, and 8 people were at the table already. And there were 2 seats that were like on basically opposite ends of the table that were remaining.
Right. I see. Yeah. Yeah.
And, so the host brought us over and was like, here's your table. And my sister and I kind of both looked at her and we were like, oh, like it would be nice if we could sit together, you know, like,
right.
Like beside each other at the table. And so then the host was like,
bye.
I think what happened was, well, it seemed like initially they got really nervous, and then they were like, okay, I'll see if I can do something to like fix it or whatever. And then she walked away, I assume, to like talk to the dining room manager or something like that. Which awesome. Like, thanks for checking for me. But I just assumed that it would probably be okay to talk to the people at the table and be like, hey, you know, would it be okay for somebody to like shift down or something so that we can sit together? And there were 2 gentlemen that were just like kind of sitting between the 2 empty seats. And I asked them if they wouldn't mind shifting over a seat so that my sister and I could sit together. And first they looked at me with like a really glazed look, like they hadn't heard anything that I said. And then, I was like, it would just be nice if like we could sit in 2 seats together. So would it be all right with you guys if, you know, like you shifted seats? And, and the one gentleman was like, oh yeah, for sure. Okay. Yeah. No problem. And then they started to get up and move. And then the other gentleman who was sitting there was like, but like we were here first though. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I mean, I guess if you really don't want to move. And then he started getting like really upset and started saying like really rude things to us. Like it was gonna like we were asking him to do something that was like totally not reasonable. And then they got up and moved, and then we all sat down. But that one gentleman was like just so angry, and he just couldn't. He was just mad, and then he wanted to move. He didn't want to sit beside us because I had asked him if it would be okay if he moved. And then eventually they got up, and then they went and talked to somebody at the front, and they got put at a different table. Yeah.
Oh, really?
And then he was like staring daggers at us throughout the entire dinner. It was just the weirdest thing. It was like the weirdest, saddest, most childish like interaction. It was just like, and like totally surprising. Like, is a dining room full of like mostly like middle-aged and older people. And I don't know. It was just like a really weird situation. Never had anything like that happen at a like fancy dinner before.
Yeah.
And then it was pretty awkward because the rest of the people at the table didn't really, you know, like they were all just like having conversations or whatever while this was kind of happening. And then when we sat down, they were like, what happened? And we had to sort of like explain to everyone like exactly kind of what had gone down. And
Right.
But everybody else at the table was really nice. And we sat kind of with like this three, like a little bit older than us people. One woman, it was her birthday. And apparently they dine at Ernest's quite a bit. And so that was really interesting because like really? I got to sort of like sit at a table with like people who like Ernest's is like their go-to fancy meal. So that was neat.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did you pick their, you picked her brain? You're like, well, what do you really think about the food here? Like that? Or what?
Not exactly, but I did tell her that I know the chef, so.
Oh, okay.
But they were kind of more picking my brain about the food, actually, because I was sort of like talking about it with my sister, and then I think they kind of like figured out that I was a cook or something, and so they were asking me about some of the food and some of the things as the dishes came out.
So speaking of the food then, bread first?
Yeah, we had bread.
Do you have any comments on bread?
Yeah, the breads were pretty good. There was a bread, I think, that had like cherries in it or something.
Yeah, roasted grapes.
Oh, okay.
I think so. There was supposed to be one that was more, that was Okanagan inspired and one that was Alberta inspired. And I think that for the bread and actually also for the dessert, both Rod and Blair just let the
team do.
Pastry department figure it out. They're always like, I'm not trying to minimize Chef Butters or Chef Lebsack, but they often are like, because they have more like line cooking backgrounds, they don't want to like dictate pastry recipes to a pastry department. And so often they're just like, yeah, something like this, but you guys just do it. And so if I remember right, the Okanagan inspired one, it had roasted grapes. And I think another element that I'm, that's totally escaping me now. And the Alberta inspired one, I think.
Does that sound right?
Is that what you
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I think the bread, this is probably some of the best bread that I've had at Ernest's actually. Like it was really quite good. The dessert, I mean, we'll get there, but the dessert felt very much like most of the desserts that get from the Ernest's like pastry team, and some, they're kind of hit and miss, and this one was a bit of a miss, I feel like, but there was some nice components on it, but yeah, there was some things about it that I didn't really love, but yeah. And so then it was kind of like the dinner itself too, it was sort of like a bit of a laborious process because there was a lot of like coming out, like people coming out and introducing dishes and talking about, you know, what the dinner was for and what the fundraiser was for. And there was, it was kind of interspersed amidst like the serving of the courses, which, you know, can be okay if it all works out that, you know, you're waiting for your course anyways, and then somebody's like introducing the next course. But some of the timing seemed a little weird. It seemed a little drawn out and maybe a little drawn out because of the, the speaking that was going on in between
the
courses
program,
and things
right?
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. First course.
Oh, like a wedding where you're not actually that close to.
Yeah. Kind of like that actually.
To the bride and groom.
Yeah. I'm sure there was a lot of context and it made sense to everyone who was putting on the dinner. But you know, as a diner without the like sort of overall context, I feel like I probably could have done with, just like, some briefer descriptions of the dishes by the chefs who sort of like made them or whatever. But yeah, first course was Polly River Arctic Char, asparagus, morels, anchovy, roasted radish, hollandaise, and bee pollen. And then there was a wine pairing for each course. And this one, and the, all of the wine pairings were from Dirty Laundry Winery, which seems like seems to be a winery that works pretty closely with Ernest. Like it seems like every time I'm there, the wines by the glass are Dirty Laundry wines and things like that. Is that fair to say? Or
so, sorry, every wine for the dinner was from Dirty Laundry? Is
that's
that right?
Right?
Oh, really? Oh,
I did, like the owner or somebody from the winery was there, and he was also getting up in between courses and talking about the wine and talking about the winery and actually like making a point to like sell people the wine during the dinner, which I thought was also really weird. He got up and like gave a speech about how, you know, they have a sign up sheet for ordering cases of the different wines and that you could like sign up and get on their like mailing list for wine cases at the front, which was interesting to get a sales pitch in the middle of dinner. But so, yeah, this was the first dish that came out. There was also a lily stem or something on the dish that wasn't listed on the menu that Chef Butters said that was just sort of like something that happened to be available right when he was like coming to put on the dinner. And so he just brought some with him, I think is what happened. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was, I guess, a piece of roasted char. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the hollandaise seemed like, it was, what's the word? Like, aerated?
Aerated? Yeah. Is that what you mean? Or, I was thinking the whole time that we were making, I was like, oh, Shale would love this because it was cooked sous vide. It was put in an ISI canister. Yeah. And, which I wouldn't say that I was skeptical of the procedure, but I was like, I don't know. I was like, so are we doing all this just to make a nice hollandaise? But when it came out of the canister, I was surprised, like it held its shape really well. It stayed aerated for very well and it tasted good. I thought,
yeah, so. It's just sort of like, it adds a little bit like texturally, it makes it a little bit different from other hollandaise that most people have usually had. So it just like elevates the experience, I think, a little bit.
And I know you've talked about aerating hollandaise, and I can't remember if it was from a canister or not, but I know that you've talked about that before. Was it like, is that what district hollandaise was in your day? Was it from a canister?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's where I'm remembering it from then. I was like, this is like a Shale recipe. Yeah.
So was it like a Butters recipe too? Was that his?
Yes.
It was like at his behest?
It's the Sunny's. Yeah. It's the recipe from Sunny's. That Rod sent us, and he was very particular, and I would almost say he was a little bit nervous about, because like when I told him, for instance, like one of the details of the recipe is that you put it into a 1 liter ISI canister, and I was like, well, we have half liter,
right?
So that's what we have in our lab. Can we put it in 2 half liters or whatever it was? And he was like, I don't know if I'll sleep tonight if we put it in a half liter. And so I was able to go to find, I think like one of the adjacent pastry labs had
1 liter ones,
had one or one, 1.5 or whatever it was, liter canisters. Yeah. And so he was like, ah, okay.
We're okay. I mean, I can kind of relate. It is a very temperamental thing. You kind of have to get everything right. You know, like, and the size of the canister does matter because,
for a number of reasons.
Like
how many charges,
for how many charges you're going to put in, and then for how much, you know, product is going to be in there, how much of, you know, how much gas then aerates the hollandaise, and do you get the correct texture and stuff like that. So, yeah, I can.
And even the recipe as it was sent to us, it had notes like, don't scale this recipe.
Right.
You can make one of these recipes, or you can make two, or you can make three, but you can't scale it. You just measure the ingredients as they are in the recipe. And that's one
canister,
that kind of thing. And even to give you an idea of how clueless I was about it, even though you've tried to tell me for years about the merits of this process, before, like we had prepped the hollandaise, it was still in sous vide bags. And I think one of the Team Nate members, like I had assembled the canisters, and she mentioned like, so am I meant, it had the like the floret tip on it, and she was like, so how am I meant to pipe this? I was like, oh, don't worry, it's just a hollandaise, like it'll just come out like a hollandaise. But then sure enough, they started plating it, and like it came out like in the beautiful, like, yeah, like a Duchesse kind of pattern. And I hope I made it clear. I mentioned it was like, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong. You were right. It does come out with, and it holds its shape. So, anyways, yeah. And then, yeah, the char, this Pali River char, so P-A-A-L-I, I think it's spelled, I believe in Northwest Territories. And yeah, they brought in the whole fish and Rod cleaned them and portioned them with the students. It was beautiful yeah. fish. And yeah, it was just roasted. It was interesting. There were no real cooking instructions in the recipes that he had sent before, but when he got there, he was like, I want it basically just set. Right. Like I don't like it, it. Yeah, it's cooked, but like it's, you know, it's the fish is set and it's served warm, and which was interesting to me because that's never how we would usually describe. Like we would say we want the fish medium or we want it medium rare or whatever. But he was like, just set. And so I was personally the one who was just happened to be putting the fish in and taking it out of the oven. And I brought it over to him the first time because I thought it matched
what he was describing.
And then he was not hemming and hawing, but kind of like, he was like, well, okay. So for our guests, like, do you think this is too under? And I said, yeah, maybe Edmonton. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I would probably do it a little bit more. And so how was it when it came to
it was beautiful.
Like, how was the fish?
I would say the description, of just set is kind of a subjective thing, just, you know, but it was like, mm-hmm. very moist still, like, but flaking apart all the way through. And yeah, it was pretty perfect. Was there any guidance given for like the skin, for how to cook the skin, or in what way the skin should?
Well, they were briefly seared. The full procedure after it was cleaned mm-hmm. and portioned, they were briefly pan seared, set skin up in hotel pans. I cooked them in the rationale at a quite fairly low temperature, I think 275, till that doneness. They were taken out and then students torched them with butane. So that's how the skin color and yeah, the top. You can kind of, I'm sure you've seen this before, like when you torch the skin like that and the meat isn't fully cooked, the fish kind of arches mm-hmm. up like where you're torching it. And then that was it. And then it was on the plate.
I that's kind of what I suspected. And for me, it was such a beautiful piece of fish and the skin was still delicious. And I ate the skin of mine, but the skin wasn't really crispy. And so I think for a lot of people, they just like pulled it off because it was kind of a little bit leathery and they just like pulled it off and didn't eat it, which is kind of a shame because the skin is like, it's like got this like really kind of like unctuous fatty quality on the char because, you know, they have like a fat layer that runs basically the entire length of the fish, like just below the skin and between the skin and the meat. And that's a really great part of the fish. Yeah, I don't know. It's tricky because like I think if the skin was really crispy, that would be one thing. And then you'd have the skin side up and you would just be able to cut through it with your fork and it would just break because it's crispy. But that wasn't really happening. I don't know if it worked out that way for some people's portion. But I think like with the way that it was, I probably would have chosen to present it with the skin side down. Because it would have been easier to like cut through the skin and, you know, because it didn't have that sort of like crispiness or whatever, I think like the color of the fish might have been a little bit more visually appealing. But yeah, that I would say is like the one thing about the dish that I found maybe a little bit, I don't want to say disappointing because it was delicious. Like it was probably one of the best pieces of char I've ever had. But yeah, that I did find was like a little bit unfortunate. Anyway, I really liked this dish. It was simple.
Didn't feel simple in the kitchen. So a lot of components.
There's a lot of components. I probably would have gone with fewer, honestly. Like there's asparagus on it, right? The asparagus was great. There are morels. Mm-hmm. The morels were amazing. And there was roasted radish, but then there was like also oven dried tomato or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then some microgreens and some sliced radish and stuff. So, you know, probably could have gone, it probably would have been, I think, just as good without the sliced radish and the microgreens and the oven roasted tomato. Just like the roasted radish and the asparagus and the morels and mm-hmm. the pickled lily stem. Is that what it was?
Yeah, pickled shoot, lily
yeah.
shoot. Yeah,
yeah, right. That was delicious. Yeah. I don't know what it was pickled in, but man, it was super tasty, like really nice and bright and fresh tasting. I really enjoyed that.
Well, it's funny because like, even though char isn't from the Okanagan, when I read the description of this dish, I was like, oh, this is like late April, early Okanagan, because it's got asparagus and yeah. morels. And I know that was sorry to keep dropping this, but when I was at Naramata, it was like the very end right. of asparagus and morel season. And that was like something that was understandably fetishized on right. menus there. And one funny thing during the procurement process, I had read this menu and I had seen that the procurement lead had brought in dried morels.
Oh God.
And I saw that and I was like, oh, I don't know. And it was kind of like at the last minute, not the last minute, but say a few days when a kind of order deadline was approaching before the event, I emailed her and was like, I think that Rod Butters actually wants fresh morels. But it was kind of this to do because there was a looming deadline for the earliest we could, because we're just seeing them in right. Edmonton, like we're just seeing fresh morels at say like the Italian Center and stuff. And they cost, I don't know, like $50 a mm-hmm. pound or something. But I emailed her because I was having this, I was worried that we were going to disappoint Rod. And so we had this like frantic, this flurry of emails back and forth. Cause it was literally like I emailed and then she was like, okay, I'll look into it. And like, okay, yeah. Like the deadline is 10 a.m. Oh, I need God. To know in the next 5 minutes. And it was so expensive. Like we probably would have needed 5 or 10 pounds to do this yeah. service. And it's a fundraiser and stuff. And so I was like, okay, never mind. Forget it. And so we didn't order them. And one of the first things when Rod finally got to our kitchens and we were going over like, you know, what product we had brought in and what prep we had done, I like nervously was like, and just so you know, we were only able to procure dried morels. And he was like, oh great. That's better. Anyways, I prefer them much fair. More fresh. So,
that's good.
Yeah. For this application anyways, but
I like this dish. I really like the fish. I really liked the lily shoot. The hollandaise was very I've had that style of hollandaise so many times before that it wasn't really surprising to me. So and bee pollen, I don't know, I've put it on dishes before, I've worked at restaurants where it was on dishes before. I don't really think it adds much. I mean, it's nice if you have it. It's like, you know, a interesting foraged ingredient that you can have or something like that. But yeah, I've never seen it used in a way that really changed the perception of a dish for me. It's more just like an extra little garnish to make things seem fancy, in my opinion. But And then next course was smoked duck breast, spring onions, spaghetti squash, hemp seeds. I'm just going to, I have pictures of all these dishes, and so I will provide them to you, Alan, so that you can put them on our Instagram.
Sure.
This, I would say, was still nice. Probably my least favorite of the dishes that we had. Like it seemed like a really nice duck breast. The skin wasn't very crispy. I really liked the sort of spaghetti squash kind of like, there was like something else in it that was binding the spaghetti squash together. Hey, like.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting to me that wasn't on the menu
right.
description. But Range Road or Blair, and I think they've used this at Range Road, they call it a Banya Cotta, or something like their Alberta twist on a Banya Cotta. So it's like it's white wine and lemon juice and an emulsion of butter and cold pressed canola and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's roasted garlic in it.
Yeah, I think a Banya Cotta, usually it's like the emulsifying component is garlic. So you're like stirring like either like oils or something into roasted garlic, and the roasted garlic is sort of like what helps emulsify everything.
Yeah, to me, it's garlic, anchovy, and olive oil. Right. I don't know if that's like the definition of it, but those are the ingredients that I associate with it. No anchovy in this one, I don't think, but this was butter and cold pressed canola, and to me that was actually the star of the star of the dish, was that that tangy, buttery, oily sauce in the spaghetti squash, which is an ingredient that I usually just like think is so unsexy I never even putting on a menu.
Yeah, but I would say spaghetti squash for me is one of the things that I have the most trouble coming up with good ways to make it delicious. I don't know why. Like I do like it, but I don't know. I always think that like it can only have kind of like one format, because when you cook it, then you get all these strands, and then what do you do with that, right? And my imagination just doesn't work very well with it for some reason. But this was really great, really amazing. It really it was sort of a spaghetti squash revelation for me. So I like that.
And some interesting garnishes in there, if I remember right. Like there was dried Bing cherries,
right?
And there are pops of flavor. The duck breast, I was pretty happy with the smoke flavor. Mm-hmm. It was just like it was kind of seared and rendered and then cold smoked. The instruction was like the intention was to cook it medium. I think a lot of them came out a little bit more, I would say, medium well. I do wish, like, if we had had a little bit more time, we've talked about this ad nauseum, but like we were already dry aging ducks in this lab all term, and so it would have been awesome to have some dry aged ducks.
Yeah,
enough backlog to use the dry aged ducks, because it would have meant for some crispy skin and delicious flavor.
Yeah, and then that would have fulfilled my other Ernest bucket list thing of trying the duck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So nice dish. I like the inventive squash presentation. In terms of execution, just like, man, it's so hard. Like when you're trying to serve 110 people or whatever all at the same time, like how can you have every duck breast be crispy and medium unless you have 30 experienced cooks searing duck breasts, you know? Like it's a really tricky thing to pull off.
Right.
And it was good. But yeah, you know, definitely like the skin wasn't really as crispy as it should be. I don't think mine was like medium well. I think it was closer to medium than it was to medium well. And it was still nice. It was delicious. Like you said, I think the smoke level was perfect. Tasted really good, but but yeah, just like it's a little underwhelming because you're like, oh man, duck. I love duck. And then it comes and it's like, okay, well, this is pretty normal. Mm-hmm. Then we had a passion fruit sorbet as a palate cleanser, which I'm assuming was just provided by the pastry team.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it was actually like really good. It was intense. Like, was it just like passion fruit puree that they procured that they were using to make it, or?
I know absolutely nothing about it. I would be shocked if it weren't
some kind of
from a
like retail product
purchase puree, like a Boiron brand puree. Yeah. But
anyway, yeah, that was really nice. Then we had the last savory dish, cuts of beef. So was this like a collab dish? Do you know or? Yeah, okay.
Yes. Yeah, it was, yeah.
So it's called Cuts of Beef. It has dried strip loin, braised beef cheek, beef tendon, bone marrow, root vegetable torte, herb chutney, and reduce stock as the sauce. So a demi-glace kind of, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, it was pretty epic. This was a pretty amazing, dish. I wouldn't necessarily, aside from the fact that it's like bringing so many pieces of beef together, like in one presentation, the other thing that was like really quite inventive about it was the beef tendon, which was cooked as like a fried crisp, like kind of like a prawn cracker or something, but yeah. Made out of beef tendon.
Yeah. Like chicharron.
Yeah. Which was amazing.
That I had never seen that before. Didn't understand. Like I read a description sort of in the menu and was like, and it just said there was a note in the the package that we received from the chef, and it was like Rod Wilbrin.
Oh, really?
And he brought.
Can I? Do you know how he made it? Can I guess?
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
You braise beef tendon until it's soft but not falling apart. Then you slice it in.
Can you braise beef tendon until it's falling apart?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, like.
Okay, sorry, just asking. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you.
I mean, you can braise it until it dissolves. Like, it will eventually just dissolve. Like, in pho, when you have tendon, it's usually, like, very soft. And, like, the outside of it, you can tell, has, like, been cooked so much that it's starting to, like, dissolve away. Yeah.
Okay.
So braise it until it's like soft but not falling apart. Cut it into thin slices, like probably like an eighth of an inch thick slices. Then lay those slices out in a food dehydrator and dehydrate them until they're almost completely dry, and then deep fry them.
Yeah, that sounds
really?
Pretty close.
Okay.
It's chicharron method, as we've discussed. Yeah. In Rod's own words, you take the tendons and you boil the shit out of them.
Okay.
So I don't know what that timeline looks like. One thing that he mentioned that wasn't in your description was that he presses them.
Oh, that makes sense.
And that probably just to make it easier to slice, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't actually know what thickness they're sliced at, but then they're definitely dehydrated. And when they were and that's the state they were brought to us. Like we only
and then
fried,
you fried them,
on
there.
Site.
Yeah.
Yeah. But certainly by the time they were dried out, they were thinner than an eighth of an inch. And so, but that's a reasonable guess for how they were sliced after cooking. And I never, like I said, never seen it, never heard of it. It was delicious.
Yeah.
Inventive.
It was great.
I was actually shocked at when I read the description of the dish, I was like, okay, yeah, it's like a whole bunch of different kinds of beef on a plate. Don't really understand the tendon. The other did you mention the beef cheek in the
Yeah, I mentioned
dish
the
description?
Beef cheek, okay. But I didn't say how it was prepared.
Yeah. So that's also like when you read the dish description, I was like, okay, yeah, like a braised beef, a grilled beef, namely the strip loin, this crispy fried tendon and bone marrow. So yeah, okay, yeah, it's four cuts of beef. Cool. But then once I read the recipe of the beef cheek.
Right.
And the description of the tendon, it was like, oh yeah, like this is actually
fancy.
And then when I saw them actually put the plate together, I was like, this is very ambitious, modern, delicious.
Yeah.
It was a cool dish. It was great.
Yeah. I would say it was my favorite. The root vegetable tort was also great. Like really thinly sliced, like, root vegetables like stacked up, and then and the beef cheek was wrapped in caul fat, so like en crepinette, I guess is what you would call it.
Yeah, and it wasn't just so it was like braised beef cheeks that had been chilled and then chopped and mixed with a bit of their cooking liquid and some of the mirepoix too, I believe, and then wrapped into these en crepinette in these little rounds. And so what was I tasted the mix before it was wrapped in the caul, but I didn't actually taste them hot. What was the eating experience like?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it looked like this like weird kind of little, yeah, disc or something.
Like a puck, yeah.
Like a puck, yeah. And then basically when you cut through it with your fork, the caul fat just like cut perfectly, and then you get like, yeah, this is basically what's like, you know, like pulled beef cheek, which is probably my favorite cut of beef, is the cheek.
Easy now, Shell, easy.
I don't know. It's up there. Yeah, I mean, this dish was obviously very rich. There's a lot of meat. There's a lot of like really rich things on the plate. But yeah, it was delicious. There was like a little, oh yeah, they call it a herb chutney that was on the piece of strip loin. The strip loin was like exquisitely beefy and very tender. And yeah, just really nice.
And that's another thing that like one of the great elements of this dish that was just kind of imported into the Ernest kitchens. Like the strip loin was dry aged at the butchery by Range Road. I can't remember how long. And then the students who were in charge, and sorry, I think I kind of mentioned this at the, but just to be clear, like every student in my class was assigned one of these preparations from right. the reception or the dinner. A couple weeks, well, when they started the class, so a couple weeks before this dinner. And yeah, so having the really amazing product from the butchery, and the students just like nailed the doneness of that strip loin.
Right. Oh yeah. It was so perfect.
To have the, and the way it's a really fun, like it sounds like a trivial or a silly thing, but the idea of being able to cook these, they were massive strip loin steaks, like cut probably 2.5 inches thick. That's how they were grilled. But then they were carved like into these single kind of like fingerling strips, where you have this nice little cap of fat on the very top, and then the perfect cross section of the mid-rare meat on the plate. Yeah, I was... Yeah, it was thrilling to see that go.
I'm actually shocked to hear that they were just like grilled to that doneness. Like I thought for sure it was like sous vide or something, because like it was pretty like from edge to edge the same doneness. And I was like, yeah, right. Wow.
They were colored on the grill and then finished in the oven.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
But they were, I think that like they were very like under Blair's instruction, they were very careful about how they were grilled. They made sure that the fat cap of the strip stayed on the grill to render out. They were put into an oven. I don't know the temperature, to be honest, but like it was a fairly moderate oven so that it cooked right. Very evenly, and then just pulled at the right time, rested the amount of time, carved carefully, and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this dish. I don't really know what else to say about it aside from everything was like pretty perfect. The marrow was also great. I mean, nothing really special there, but.
The other thing though, and I have found this time and time again, just the past term serving the dry aged duck, is that it really helps, like having a really well dry aged piece of meat. Mm. The eating quality is... The perception of moisture and depth of flavor is just so much more profound than a generic cut. I'm sure that contributed a lot to like to your eating experience in terms of the doneness.
Absolutely. Like so, yeah, like it was just so tender and so beefy because of that dry aging. Like, yeah, it was great. Yeah, wish I could go back and eat this one again. I was like feeling a little under the weather when we ate that dinner, and I was a little bit like stuffed up, and I was like regretting it because I was like, oh man, I feel like I'm not even quite tasting how good this is, but it was still so good. Yeah. And I mean, like I'm a real sucker for bone marrow too. So, mm-hmm. And this dish when it came out was like probably the one that like, other people at the table had the most questions about. Like, they were really curious about what was going on with the cheek and like how it was wrapped and
right.
You know, and the tendon, like everyone read tendon on the menu, but they were like, I don't know if I've ever had tendon before. And then I like,
right.
And I wasn't sure what format the tendon was going to be in. I just assumed maybe it would be a braised piece or something, or that was encapsulated in something, or I wasn't sure. But when it came out with this big crisp on top, I was like, whoa, cool. So yeah, that was fun. I got to sort of like talk through
wax eloquent about,
about the components of the dish.
If we can talk about like the way that the dish was presented, was it I was actually genuinely surprised because it, to me, for what I know about them, both of these chefs have a fairly often a very rustic like presentation style,
right?
And everything's kind of it's attractive, but it's like it's laid out there and you can see everything. And this one was. It was a linear presentation.
A little more architectural, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a strip across the center of the plate, basically presented like perpendicular to the guest, right? Like it was like stretching away from the guest. And it was, the four components in a line. And am I remembering this right?
Yep.
Was the strip loin, the cheek, the root veg tort. And the bone marrow, kind of in a nice tidy line.
That's right.
And then each of them had a kind of interesting garnish that didn't obscure the element that it was placed on. Mm-hmm. So I think one of them, one of them had the tendon, one of them had a Brussels sprout leaf, one of them had the daub of herb chutney.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the last, but it was like linear but still natural, and you could still see everything, and I was really spitten with it.
This was a really good dish. Really well thought out, really well executed, almost worth the price of admission. And then after that we had dessert, which I'd say was kind of so-so. There were some interesting components on it. I think the thing that I liked the most was there was sort of like...
Wait, tell us what the dish was.
Okay, sorry.
What was it called?
Strawberry rhubarb crisp. Vanilla cream, wild rice rocher, and orange gel. So it was like stewed rhubarb and strawberries on the bottom of the plate. And then something that is like not really mentioned, aside from the fact that the dish is a crisp, the like oat crackery sort of like the thing that would normally be on the top of a crisp was like sort of a set cookie, kind of like a frilly cookie, kind of.
Okay,
I'm assuming made with oats or something like that. That part I really liked. And then there were like little clusters of puffed wild rice, which I'm assuming was the wild rice rocher. And those were pretty tasty. And then there was vanilla cream, which was like a really thick pastry cream flavored with vanilla. And then there was also a candied strawberry stem on top as a garnish.
Right, like the leaves, just this surprised me because I had never seen it before, even though I've grown strawberries lots. Like not just this, like the whole leaf cap on that you would pick off the top of a strawberry, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Like crystallized and candied.
Yeah, with crystallized sugar on it. It was like crisped up, like either it was dried or something, and then candied with crystallized sugar on the outside of it. Mm-hmm. It was pretty nice. I think like it was sort of hard to get. I don't know. Like, as far as it being a crisp goes, the ratio of like crispy toppings to fruit, I think was a little bit off. It would be nice if like there was more of the crispy cookie thing. And then there was like cubes of orange gel in here, which I didn't really feel like flavor-wise did anything except detract from the flavors of the rhubarb and the strawberries. And the strawberries were really tasty, but the rhubarb was like extremely sour, like just very, like really intensely acidic. And so, yeah, I mean, parts of it were nice. I didn't necessarily love it. And it would have, like, the whole thing would have been better if, like, either it had, like, soft whipped cream or ice cream or something. But, like, the vanilla cream that was on it was just, like, a little quenelle. And it was, like, thick enough that it was hard to, like, take little bits of it off and, like, actually get it mixed in with the fruit and stuff to sort of, like, you know, because kind of with a crisp or something, like, it's warm and then you get, like, maybe some dairy that's melting down and that helps temper right. the acidity of the fruit a little bit or totally. Something like that. Yeah. And you just didn't get that effect here because the vanilla pastry cream was just sort of its own little thing that you couldn't really, it was hard to, like, mix in with the rest of the dish or whatever.
Right. One thing that I'll say is that I don't think I've ever eaten a crisp or crumble of any kind, whether it's rhubarb or otherwise, where I didn't wish that the crisp or crumble was a little bit more generous and the fruit was a little less generous.
That's fair.
Like, so, yeah, I feel like the ratio, accurate, the ratio is always off. Like, it, yeah, no, even you're if right. it's only, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, honestly, I think that the rule of thumb should be, I mean, obviously it depends on the fruit and what your topping is, but the ratio should be at most two, in terms of depth, like right, in terms right. of volume, like two parts fruit to one part crisp. Like
crumble, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's usually like five parts fruit to like one part crumble.
Yeah, which is a shame, especially because usually, like, whatever, there's good apple crisps and stuff, but like if you're working mm-hmm. with rhubarb, like a really sour ingredient, you gotta think about that ratio. And it's the same with pie and tarts and everything else.
But yeah.
I don't know how intentional it was, but your observation that usually when we're eating crisp and crumble, like we're mixing a melting dairy mm-hmm. into it to temper acidity. And that's even more crucial for something like rhubarb, some kind of sour cherry. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, it was a nice, somewhat sweet way to end the meal, but definitely the dessert was not the most memorable thing about the meal, which is too bad. But I mean, I guess the takeaway is if I'm ever in Rod Butter's or Blair Lebsack's shoes where I'm like doing a fundraising dinner at somewhere, I'm just probably going to, you know, even if I'm handing off the dessert to someone, I'm probably going to just, you know, make sure that what's happening with it is a little bit more along the lines of what I think would maybe like fit in a little bit better with the meal. I don't know why you need the orange gel. Oranges aren't from here, or I mean, I guess maybe they grow some oranges in the Okanagan. Is that real?
Oh, I have no idea. Not that I've heard, but I've heard a friend of the show, Spencer, has said that they grow yuzu in the Fraser Valley. Was it yuzu?
Dang.
I think so. Yeah. Anyways, but I think like the heart of the conception for the dessert, like a rhubarb crisp makes a lot of sense for me for this sure. menu for this time of year and for these chefs. But yeah. And also passion fruits don't grow here either.
Shouldn't, no, that's definitely that. True. And yeah, that for sure stood out to me a little bit too. I was like, oh, you know,
but the flavor trumped your,
yeah. I mean, it was just so good. And yeah. And my sister loves passion fruit. She was really excited about it. So,
oh yeah.
So I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Anyway, it was a nice meal. I'm glad I finally got to come and experience an event. And then there was like some weirdness after the meal too. There was like some speakers that I wasn't aware of that were like giving a talk and stuff like that. It was overall, I would say the experience of the meal was a little bit, there were a lot of like surprises that I was not expecting that sort of detracted from the meal experience of it. And I guess part of the stuff that, like, part of what was going on in terms of, like, presentation and stuff was, like, a presentation about the Nate Culinary Olympic team. And that part of it made perfect sense to me, and I totally appreciate it. But there was some, like, yeah, there was just some, like, random stuff thrown in, like the wine sales pitch and some other things that made it a little bit of a weird experience. And I don't know who it is that, like, you know, for Ernest that plans these types of events, but I would be curious to find out, like, you know, if things went off in the way that they had intended or whatever. But mm-hmm. I got to come and have a meal, and it was great. And then we got to talk about it on the show. So worth it.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.